Columbia Radio News, welcome to Battleground 2006, live coverage of the midterm elections from the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University in New York. I'm Brett Elliott.
And I'm Alexa Danner. Tonight, we'll hear updates and analysis from the final hours of the campaign as Democrats try to win control of Congress for the first time in 12 years.
Republicans in Congress have not done their job in terms of holding the Bush White House accountable for many missteps.
The GOP has rallied its faithful and hopes to fend off a Democratic challenge.
I really feel good about where we are as Republicans because we have a record of being successful.
And we'll take a look at the widespread use of negative campaign ads in tight races around the country.
Congressional leaders have admitted covering up the predatory behavior of a congressman who used the internet to molest children.
We'll begin our coverage of the 2006 midterm elections after these headlines. A magnitude 6.3 earthquake struck the coast of Papua New Guinea earlier today. There are no immediate reports of injuries or damage, and Hawaii's Pacific Tsunami Warning Center said there was no risk of a tsunami in the wider area. LA Times editor Dean Baquette announced his resignation today. Baquette's resignation comes just weeks after the paper's publisher, Jeff Johnson, was forced to leave because of a dispute with the paper's parent company over cost cutting. Johnson and Baquette had publicly criticized the parent company for the possible job cuts. But Baquette had vowed to stay and try to convince the company to increase its investment. The cost cutting comes amid reports that the shareholders are unhappy with the company's stock price. Britney Spears filed for divorce from Justin Federline today in Los Angeles, citing irreconcilable differences. The divorce comes as no surprise to the tabloids, which has speculated frequently that the marriage was in trouble. Spears married Federline in 2004, and they have a one-year-old son and an infant son who was born September 12th. In sports, Buffalo Bills receiver Josh Reed was released from the hospital today after sustaining a bruised kidney. Reed was injured in the second quarter of Buffalo's win over Green Bay on Sunday when he was tackled after making a 6-yard catch. Coach Dick Joran is expected to give an update of Reed's condition at tomorrow's practice and announce whether he will be well enough to play against Indianapolis on Sunday. Members of the Kane campaign arrived at their headquarters early this morning to find they had been vandalized. Campaign workers discovered that keys had been broken off in the locks of the doors and the doors could not be opened. Although it's unclear who is really responsible, members of the Kane campaign have accused Menendez of the vandalism. A spokesperson for Menendez had the following response.
Maybe it was some general voters who are trying to lock Tom Kane inside his own headquarters because they're sick and tired of hearing his dishonest and malicious accusations.
The Federal Reserve reports that consumer borrowing fell in September by the largest amount since the recession in the early 1990s. Borrowing has declined at an annual rate of 0.6% in September compared with a 4.6% increase in August. A huge reduction in auto loans is believed to be partly responsible for this large drop. You're listening to Battleground 2006 from Columbia Radio News. I'm Alexa Danner.
And I'm Brett Elliott. Millions of Americans went to the polls today with party control of the U.S. Senate and U.S. House of Representatives hanging in the balance. Democrats said they had a good chance of capturing the House for the first time since 1994. Republicans, while not conceding that they would lose the House, said they were confident they would remain in charge of the Senate. There were also 36 governor's seats at stake in today's elections. With a report on the battle for the House, Akisa Omulepo of Columbia Radio News reports.
The Democrats need to pick up 15 votes to gain control of the House. Can they do it? Bill Galston, senior fellow of governance studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., thinks they can.
The Democratic Party has been quite effective in communicating its critique of and rejection of Bush administration policies. The indications are that that stance will be enough to gain a majority in at least the House of Representatives.
Tim Chapman, director for the Center of Media and Public Policy at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank, agrees.
I think a lot of people are saying, 19 to 20 seats is about what the Republicans look to lose. So, in that scenario, you have a narrow Democratic majority.
The focus of the midterm elections is viewed differently by Republicans and Democrats. Chapman of the Heritage Foundation thinks it's about the lack of effectiveness of House Republicans.
It was about a Republican base who were agitated and upset because the guys that they sent to Congress to pare back the size of government, to make government more efficient, more streamlined, actually became part of the problem.
Galston of the Brookings Institution thinks Democrats are poised to take advantage of the discontent on both sides of the House.
Democrats, I think, have correctly discerned the mood of the people. They are not satisfied with the way things are going. They want a change, and so the Democratic Party has put itself forward very generally as the agent of the change that the people want.
In a number of states, Republican incumbents are facing possible defeat. In Connecticut, two Republican seats could fall to Democrats. Chapman and Galston agree that the battleground for the House is in the North.
I think the ones to look at closest are the races up in New England, where you've got some Republican moderates like Chris Shays in Connecticut, and the race in New Hampshire. I think that some of these races are going to be pretty tough uphill running for Republicans.
The Democrats need to win a number of races in the Northeast and Midwest, seats that historically have been occupied by moderate Republicans.
President Bush's poll numbers continue to hover around 40% approval. Several members of his own party have decided to distance themselves from the president. Galston thinks this tactic will hurt the Republican Party.
History indicates that distancing oneself from an unpopular president of one's own party often doesn't work.
Chapman disagrees.
I think the president's he's a politician and he understands politics. And, I think that The White House has been doing their best to put him in situations where he can actually help.
In past midterm elections, Republicans were able to rally so-called values voters to get the vote out. Given recent sex scandals, will the Republicans be able to use that platform any longer? Chapman thinks it's time for introspection.
I think that Republicans are going to have to take a real step back and look at themselves and ask themselves how this happened. I think that a lot of them are scared of that prospect.
Galston thinks the focus has shifted.
I don't think this is a year in which the so-called social or values issues are going to have nearly as strong an influence as do classic basic issues such as peace and prosperity.
3 years into the Iraq War, peace seems nowhere in sight. As for prosperity, while the economy is making moderate gains, many workers worry about job security. All of this is combining to give Democrats hope that when all the votes are counted, they will, for the first time in a dozen years, control the House of Representatives. Aki Somolapu, Columbia Radio News.
Republicans and Democrats have worked hard to get Americans to the polls today. I asked Jim Vandehei, a political reporter for The Washington Post, what issues were most important to voters.
Clearly, this is an Iraq election. I think it's a referendum on the war for a lot of voters. If you think back to 2002 and 2004, I think the war was an issue that helped Republicans. But the war is obviously much more unpopular now, and I think working to the benefit of Democrats, to the point that on this last day you have Democrats running campaign ads in well over a dozen districts in several of the most competitive Senate races criticizing the war. You have Democratic leaders talking about Bush's management of the war and trying to really make this a referendum. Because if you look at that list of issues people care about, on every one of those lists, Iraq's at the top.
How has the wave of corruption scandals affected this year's elections, and how is it going to affect voter turnout?
Clearly, I think people are disgusted with Washington. So does that mean, well, we sit home because we just hate them all, or does it mean we turn out because we want to send a message? I don't know. I mean, if you look at it at the map, I mean, Republicans are going to lose probably at least a dozen seats that are directly attributable to scandal. Whether it's the Jack Abramoff money for favor scandal, whether it's Kurt Weldon's doing favors for his family scandal, or whether it's the Mark Foley scandal. I mean, I think there's two or three seats that could tip on that issue alone. So at the end of the day, that gets you basically to the 15 seats that Democrats need to pick up and puts Republicans in one heck of a hole. Democrats, who have their own problems with scandal, look like they're going to survive.
Just how close is this election?
It's very close. I mean, I think you got to work from the premise that we're in a country that is essentially a 50-50 country that is tilts slightly right of center. So Republicans have, I think, a minor structural advantage.
And what can we expect to happen if the Democrats win one of the houses or both?
That'd be a pretty radical change for Washington. You got to remember, Republicans have had effective hold for all of the Bush presidency. And so they've not only controlled sort of the policy formulation apparatus, but they've controlled oversight. So there's not been that much investigation. There's not been that much exploration of what's happening in the White House. I think the biggest change would be there'd be a lot of investigations. There'd be a lot of oversight. I think starting with why we went to war in the first place, the management of the war, how we've spent money over in Iraq. And I think that would make it virtually impossible for Bush to have a good end to his presidency.
Well, thanks so much for being with us, Jim. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
That was Jim VandeHei, political reporter for The Washington Post.
Republicans and Democrats are fighting to control the Senate, too. Republicans want to stay in power. Democrats hope they can retake the Senate majority for the first time since 1994. Experts say that the race for the Senate, whether Republicans hold a 10-seat margin, could come down to a few close races. Chris Brower of Columbia Radio News reports.
President Bush campaigned for Republican incumbent Senator Conrad Burns last week in Montana. Bush said he was confident Republicans would keep control of Congress.
And the reason why I believe we're going to win around this country is because Republicans understand the values and the priorities of the American people.
The president may be too optimistic. With 33 seats up for re-election today, the Democrats need a net gain of 6 seats to win control of the Senate. Rehan Salam is a former writer for the New Republic magazine who's currently working on a book about the future of the Republican Party. He says the issue on voters' minds this year is the war in Iraq.
According to the latest New York Times CBS poll, apparently the president's approval rate on Iraq is 29%, which matches the lowest level they've recorded in this poll. And I think that the number of people who are now in favor of withdrawal, somewhere in the neighborhood of 60%, which is pretty extraordinary.
Democrats want to turn that dissatisfaction into votes. But recent polls predict that the battle for control of the Senate is too close to predict. 48 states are solidly Democratic or leaning Democratic, and an equal number are in the Republican camp. Only 4, Virginia, Missouri, Montana, and Tennessee, are toss-ups. Rehan Salam has his own ideas about the outcome.
I think that it's going to be 50-50. I think that the Democrats will barely be denied control.
So, in the first of those key races, Virginia, Republican incumbent George Allen faces Democrat James Webb. The contest is too close to call.
It's a big surprise.
That's NPR correspondent Juan Williams, speaking on the network's program Day to Day.
Virginia was thought to be a safe seat for George Allen, but it's been a really rough go, and he has not handled that campaign well with lots of gaffes, racial references.
Williams was referring to a comment Allen made at a rally in August, where he called a dark-skinned Webb campaign worker macaca, a word that in some parts of the world is considered a racial slur. Fallout from that remark helped make the Virginia race competitive. But Allen struck back, accusing Webb of being disrespectful to women, and it's the women's vote that may prove key to this increasingly tight race. Missouri is the other state that could go either way. President Bush campaigned there just before the weekend.
I want to thank all the grassroots activists who are here. Grassroots activists are those who put up the signs, those who make the phone calls, those who turn out to vote.
Missouri pits Republican incumbent James Talon against Democrat and state auditor Claire McCaskill. A referendum on embryonic stem cell research is on the ballot in this state and at the top of both campaigns' agendas. Talon is against the initiative. McCaskill supports it. She won the endorsement of actor Michael J. Fox, who suffers from Parkinson's disease.
I care deeply about stem cell research. In Missouri, you can elect Claire McCaskill, who shares my hope for cures. Unfortunately, Senator Jim Talon opposes expanding stem cell research.
That ad incurred the wrath of right-wing pundits like talk show host Rush Limbaugh. Recent polls show the race has tied, but Talon can draw hope from Missouri's voting history. The GOP has lost only one U.S. Senate seat there in 25 years. Montana is the third state that's neck and neck. Democrat John Tester is challenging three-term incumbent Republican Conrad Burns. Montana has traditionally been GOP turf, but this race is personal. Burns is struggling to distance himself from disgraced lobbyist Jack Abramoff, who funneled donations to the senator's campaigns in the past. Tester pounced on the issue, including during a recent televised debate with Burns.
But I want to tell you that the fact is that you have to have people back there that have Montana values. You have to have people back there that are willing to tell people like convicted felon Jack Abramoff and his buddies, no.
Burns made a comeback over the past week. Polls now show Burns and his Democratic opponent tied. The fourth hot race tonight is for an open seat in Tennessee, where Republican Mayor Bob Corker is leading Democratic Congressman Harold Ford by a small margin. Their contest has been one of the most volatile in the nation, with allegations of racism and sexism thrown back and forth. Two more races to watch. In New Jersey, a Democrat is defending his seat. Senator Bob Menendez is trying to fend off Republican Tom Kane Jr. in a race marked by accusations of corruption and a flood of negative advertising. And in Arizona, trailing candidate Jim Peterson got a last-minute financial boost from the Democratic Party this weekend after early voting for Peterson suggested the race may be closer than assumed. For Democrats to win control of the Senate tonight, they can't lose any of the seats they currently hold, including New Jersey, and they need to win three of the four toss-ups, Virginia, Missouri, Montana, and Tennessee. Chris Brower, Columbia Radio News.
I spoke with Adam Nagurny, chief political correspondent for the New York Times. He said that this year, the Democrats might have a shot.
It appears, as of right now, that the Democrats have succeeded in nationalizing this election. What the Republicans always wanted this to be was a series of individual contests, as opposed to a referendum on the war or a referendum on President Bush. It's my suspicion, from looking at all the poll numbers, that the Democrats have succeeded, and that was always a key thing in terms of them winning this election.
How will each party's effort to increase voter turnout affect the outcome?
Well, I mean, I think it's key whichever party's better, and that can really, really make a difference. The Republican Party built a very, very, very effective get-out-the-vote operation, which can prove key in some of these low-margin races.
You described the Republicans' effort to get out the vote. What is their operation like?
I mean, they began working on it after 2000, when Karl Rove looked at the final results of voting, particularly in Florida, and realized that Democrats had done a lot better than his polling had told him, which suggested to him that the Democrats had a much better voter turnout operation. So they began working on it, and they developed something called the 72-hour plan, and they've just been improving it and using all kinds of very sophisticated consumer data to identify voters. They match polling data with voting history and demographic data, like, for example, what magazines you're subscribed to, what kind of car you drive, you go to church or not, and trying to figure out what someone's voting behavior would be. So as a result, they were able to find a whole lot of Republican-leaning voters in places where they never looked before. It's very impressive. Democrats are behind. They're trying to catch up now, but I think that was key to what happened in 2002 and 2004.
Have you noticed any difference in the way that the campaigns have been conducted as a whole this year as opposed to other years?
You know, every year we write that the campaigns get dirtier and nastier, so it feels like a cliche, but I do feel that this year. I do feel there's been a lot of really over-the-top or almost over-the-top attacks on people.
If the Democrats are able to gain control of the Congress, what effect do you think that would have on the current policy toward the war in Iraq?
I mean, that's an interesting question. I mean, the fact of the matter is, you saw Dick Cheney on his interview with George Stephanopoulos the other day. He said it would have none. And, you know, to a large extent, the war is controlled by the White House, right? Unless Congress wants to go in there and start cutting funds to finance the war, which is a really risky thing to do. So there's no direct obvious thing. You would think that if there was an election result like that, that would be so interpreted as a sign from the country that people want to get out of Iraq, that he'd try to people respond.
Do you think the verdict in the Saddam Hussein trial will have an impact?
Yeah, we wrote a front page story today about how Bush was seizing on it to try to make a difference. But I mean, it might help on the margins to get some of his base voters out. But I think it's a real long shot, and most people have already made up their mind about the war, so it's not going to switch anyone's opinion.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. Thanks
good
for taking time.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thanks. Bye.
That was New York Times correspondent Adam Nagurny from Washington. I'm Brett Elliott.
And I'm Alexa Danner. You're listening to Battleground 2006 from Columbia Radio News.
Every year, candidates spend more and more money on negative ads, and every election, people complain more and more about them. Many say that dirty campaign tactics turn them off to voting, but analysts say that sometimes that's the point. Kate McCarthy of Columbia Radio News reports.
We've heard them time and time again.
Congressional leaders have admitted covering up the predatory behavior of a congressman who used the internet to molest children.
Negative campaign ads. It's enough to make you want to...
The Bush administration and Joe Lieberman keep looking for new scare tactics to try to win elections.
So are you scared, or are you just fed up like me?
David Proctor, a professor at Kansas State University, studies ads. Despite voter complaints, he says they work.
Negative ads have the power to be more effective in changing voters or getting voters to vote in a particular way.
Joe Courtney has openly criticized the recent tax cuts, criticized cutting your income tax.
Negative ads like this one target voters and subtly, or not so subtly, try to influence the way you cast your ballot.
Federal prisoner 25038050. He's Tom Kane Jr.'s newest advisor. The Star Ledger reports...
In the hotly contested New Jersey Senate race, Democratic candidate Robert Menendez uses music to stir anxiety, while fuzzy black and white images flash across the screen. George Marcus, president of the International Society of Political Psychology, says they cause anxiety or anger in voters.
That the emotion of anxiety is the brain's way of cueing us that there's something wrong and you better pay attention. You know, if you were in a slight slumber or if you weren't paying much attention, if this soundtrack was on, it'd wake you up.
Music isn't the only way to influence voter behavior. Probably the most controversial ad of this election is the one that targets Senate candidate Harold Ford of Tennessee, who is African American.
I met Harold at the Playboy party.
The implication is that that is to remind Tennessee voters that he's black and that he's violating certain norms about that whites should socialize with whites, blacks intimately should socialize only with blacks. And that would mobilize particularly those who have a degree of racial racism, to mobilize that racism and to turn away from Ford.
The Republican Party pulled the ad after a few days, but it's negative ads like these that campaign ad expert David Proctor says are designed to do two things: mobilize the base and turn off other voters.
It really sort of turns off the independent, moderate, less politically attentive and active voter.
But Proctor says there's a price to the success of negativity. He says research shows that negative ads increase voter cynicism and distrust of the political system. Kate McCarthy, Columbia Radio News.
Northwoods Advertising, a company based in Minnesota, has helped unconventional candidates like Jesse Ventura get their message out and win elections. My colleague David Fusaro spoke with Bill Hilsman, the president of Northwoods Advertising. He explained how his unorthodox ads compare to traditional political spots.
The typical political ad is an ad that's poll-driven, has very little imagination, is done by media consultants who don't understand popular culture or advertising, and it's highly inefficient.
Mr. Hilsman, describe your approach to creating the advertising for your candidates.
Well, we employ the same approach we would take to selling products or services to consumers, because consumers are voters. We know what's on consumers' minds. We know what's on voters' minds on a day-to-day basis because we're out there every day. We're selling products and services to them.
We're going to give a listen right now to one of the ads that you produced for Ned Lamont, the Democrat who's trying to unseat Joe Lieberman in Connecticut.
Meet Ned Lamont. He can't make a decent cup of coffee.
Everybody wang chung tonight.
He's a bad karaoke singer. And he has a messy desk.
Aren't you sick of political attack ads that insult your intelligence? Senator Lieberman, let's stick to the issues and pledge to support whoever wins the Democratic primary. I'm Ned Lamont, and I approve this message.
His coffee's really not that bad.
Mr. Hilsman, that spot seems to poke fun at traditional campaign advertising. Tell us a little bit about what you were trying to accomplish with that ad.
Well, we basically were trying to inoculate Ned against the attacks that we knew were going to be coming. So what we did was we did a parody of a typical TV attack ad and just made fun of the whole genre. And then when the attack ads inevitably came, people would remember the ad that we did and say, oh, this is just more ridiculous political attack crap. That ad, by the way, the first day it was put up, was the most viewed YouTube video in the world.
You mentioned internet advertising, or at least or YouTube, and many of your ads for the Kinky Friedman campaign were made specifically for the internet. How effective is web advertising?
Well, it's getting more and more effective. It's not a mass medium yet, but it is a way to amplify your mass media and to get messages out to people who may not be utilizing mass media that much.
Now, we've seen a lot of candidates come to you and your firm as the underdog, as the outsider, often seeking cost-effective campaign advertising. What are some of the cost-effective marketing strategies that you employ?
Well, the biggest one is amplification. What we try to do are make the commercials appealing to the audiences. If the voters are talking about your commercials, then the press is going to want to write about them or talk about them. And that gives you an amplification effect that's worth a lot of paid media money. So unless we're being outspent 3-1 or 1.5-1, I actually think we're in a pretty close to a parity situation. As I like to say, when our ads come on, people don't leave the room to go to the bathroom or go to the refrigerator. When our ads come on, people yell to other people in the house and say, hey, come on in, that ad I've been telling you about is on.
Mr. Hilsman, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Bill Hilsman, president of Northwoods Advertising, and my colleague David Fusaro. Several candidates have apologized to their supporters and constituents this political season. Last week, Senator John Kerry said he was sorry for a joke he botched about the Iraq War. Earlier, Republican George Allen, in a tight race to hold on to his Virginia Senate seat this fall, expressed regret for using a racial slur. And a tide of concessions has followed the resignation of Florida Representative Mark Foley. New York's Tom Reynolds is one representative trying to extricate himself from the Foley scandal and at the same time win a bid for re-election. Jennifer Collins of Columbia Radio News reports.
As the leader of House Republican campaign efforts, Tom Reynolds could have sounded the alarm about Congressman Mark Foley's emails last spring, before Foley started running for re-election, before the correspondence became public, before the story became a daily headline. But Reynolds did nothing. As a result, he faced a firestorm of criticism. To save his own seat in the House, Reynolds took an unusual political step. He went on TV with a 60-second mea culpa about his role in the Foley scandal.
Nobody's angrier and more disappointed than me that I didn't catch his lies. I trusted that others had investigated. Looking back, more should have been done, and for that, I am sorry.
Tell the truth. Always tell the truth. I recommend that highly. The truth is not overrated. It's very, very good.
Letitia Romaro is a Republican campaign manager. She's advised some candidates on how to say they're sorry. But she says there are limits.
It's a very personal thing, sorry. If a candidate does it too often, I'd say we ought to examine whether or not they ought to be holding the position.
Romaro says Tom Reynolds had no choice but to apologize for his inaction in the Foley scandal.
When they have hurt someone by their actions, and that's the very rare occasion that I would say sorry.
I mean, I think it's very hard for these gentlemen who get caught with these situations to sort of work their way out of it.
That's Lee Meringoff. As the director of the Marist Poll, Meringoff tracks the public's response to scandals.
The news cycles move very quickly, and you want to contain the story, but between the media and your opponent, there's a great interest in keeping it going.
Meringoff founded the Poughkeepsie-based polling organization in 1978. His favorite apology dates back to 1952.
Richard Nixon's checker speech, how's that?
Why is that one?
It was good.
The Checkers speech is widely regarded as the first televised mea culpa in American politics. In it, Richard Nixon, then a candidate for vice president, addressed allegations that he had taken personal presents, including a beguiling Cocker Spaniel, from campaign supporters.
We did get something, a gift. And our little girl, Tricia, the six-year-old, named it Checkers. And you know, the kids, like all kids, love the dog. And I just want to say this right now, that regardless of what they say about it, we're going to keep him.
Like Nixon, Congressman Reynolds has benefited from his mea culpa. But political apologies can be a tricky business. Another congressman, Don Sherwood, got no relief at the polls after he made a televised apology last month. Sherwood, a Pennsylvania Republican, was caught cheating on his wife with a younger woman. Here's what he told voters.
While I'm truly sorry for disappointing you, I never wavered from my commitment to reduce taxes, create jobs, and bring home our fair share. Should you forgive me, you can count on me to keep fighting hard for you and your family.
So you can't apologize your way out of something like that.
Tom Edsel, who has covered politics for 25 years for the Washington Post, says Sherwood's ad may have been too little and too late.
When you get that kind of scandal, a kind of scandal that the public can understand, grasp easily, like a sex scandal or pages, then you have to act quickly to staunch the bleeding.
And as the polls start closing tonight, politicians will find out whether their public confessions have persuaded voters to absolve them. Jennifer Collins, Columbia Radio News.
Candidates have put television ads on their websites for years, but with the growth of the video sharing website YouTube.com, anyone can now post files on the web. With more than 70 million videos on the site, voters have a political treasure chest of material to browse through. Matt Kozar of Columbia Radio News reports.
Call it Election 2006, YouTube style. Launched last December by three 20-year-olds, the video sharing website is experiencing its first election season, and negative ads and political blunders have high viewing numbers, especially among younger voters. When incumbent Republican Senator George Allen from Virginia called his opponent's supporter a macaca, a racial slur that means monkey, the political gaffe found a home on YouTube.com.
So welcome. Let's give a welcome to Macaca here. Welcome to America and the real world of Virginia.
And parodies of the blunder have also been posted, like the Macaca Blues song.
I normally vote Republican. I'm not sure what to do. I guess I got me a big old case of the Macaca Blues.
Anyone can post videos on YouTube, free, and it's become so popular that the internet search engine Google recently bought the company for $1.65 billion. The site archives footage that may have lost its newsworthiness for TV or print. Letitia Romaro, who worked as a Republican campaign manager, says that YouTube attracts voters because of the negative ads that it continues to play.
An entity like that is probably prime for, you know, negative campaigning. That's probably a great place to get out, you know, some video, some negative, you know, stuff on an opponent, because it'll carry. And you know, we all know that negative stuff is sexy.
And negative political videos do get lots of hits, like this one criticizing Tom Kaine Jr., the Republican challenger to the New Jersey Senate seat.
Tom Kaine Jr. follows George Bush on Iraq. Kaine Jr. says he would have voted for the Iraq War. And we should stay the Bush administration's course with no end and no victory in sight.
What will YouTube change the political landscape? Todd Gitlin, Columbia University professor of journalism and sociology, says it's too early to tell.
YouTube probably intensifies the awareness that of the campaigns, how they're being seen, and probably lends itself to inflammatory polarization. But over time, it might also persuade some of the advertisers that they need to cool it. It's not clear how it's going to play out.
But at least for the present moment, voters can use YouTube to find the good, the bad, and the ugly from the candidates. Matt Kozar, Columbia Radio News.
You're listening to Battleground 2006 from Columbia Radio News. I'm Alexa Danner.
And I'm Brett Elliott.
Pennsylvania is home to Senator Rick Santorum, the third most powerful Republican in the Senate. But that seat looks like a win for Democrats on election night. Katya Schoenberg of Columbia Radio News reports.
56-year-old Joseph Harris leans back in his cab while driving through the streets of Philadelphia. The lifelong Pennsylvanian says he can't wait to vote on Tuesday.
I'm a Republican, and I'm going to give Bush and the White House a big surprise come Tuesday.
He plans to vote for Democratic State Treasurer Bob Casey Jr. Harris says Casey shares his views on the war in Iraq.
We've been in Iraq too long. We should be out of there, and we do not belong in there. I never believed we should have been in there. Anyway, I'm a Vietnam veteran. I've seen it happen in Vietnam, and I don't think we should be there at all.
Rick Santorum's ardent support of the Iraq War has driven many voters to the Democratic camp. In the hotly contested area of southeast Pennsylvania, the senator's close alignment with the president has become a liability. 41-year-old Anthony Maynor says Santorum is not independent enough.
Seems like a follower, like a yes man. You know, you stand up, have ideas of your own.
23 miles from Philadelphia in the town of Bluebell, campaign signs for the Republican senator line the streets. Here, Kathy Marr, a 64-year-old Santorum campaign volunteer, warns conservative voters not to be swayed by Casey's pro-life position.
He's supported by NARAL, the National Abortion Rights Action League, and he has stated that he is not interested in getting pro-life justices on the Supreme Court.
Over the last few weeks, polls have shown Casey leading by up to 15 percentage points. David Stone served as communications director to the late Governor Robert Casey, the candidate's father. He says the poll numbers reflect disillusionment with the direction of the country.
We're at a moment in our country where the people who believe things are on the wrong track greatly outnumber those who think things are going well. And at that moment, A, if you're an incumbent in the governing majority, you're in trouble. And B, if you're like Rick Santorum, who has really personified a Republican leadership that has failed on so many fronts in terms of managing the government, you're really going to be in trouble.
I'm Bob Casey. After all the noise of this campaign year, I wanted to talk with you about what lies ahead.
Some say Casey's stances are too vague, a criticism he tries to address in his latest ads.
From terrorism is for Democrats and Republicans to start working together again.
Virginia Davis, the press secretary for the Santorum campaign, concedes that the Iraq War has hurt the GOP. But she argues that the Democrats' failure to come up with a viable alternative has left an opening for the incumbent.
He's not worried about the poll numbers. Out on the ground, feeling the energy and the enthusiasm as the center is traveling, it's not reflected in the poll numbers.
Hi, my name is Skyler, and I'm a local volunteer.
The Santorum campaign has been scrambling to boost voter turnout by using phone banks and going door-to-door as part of a 72-hour program. Davis says she's confident the massive effort will get the senator elected for the third time.
Thank you for your time. This call is paid for by the Republican.
Rick Santorum has raised $22 million for his campaign, compared to Casey's $16 million. And the senator has spent a bulk of the money on TV ads. David Stone says Santorum's monetary advantage hasn't helped him at all.
You have an incumbent who spent $20 or $25 million on TV and can't get his reelect number above 40.
Santorum is known to be a tough campaigner. Recently, the senator started running an ad that questions Casey's competence on national security issues.
North Korea, close to a nuclear missile to reach America, yet Casey opposes deploying a missile defense system now.
Pennsylvania has voted Democratic in the last two presidential elections and Republican in the last two Senate races. Rick Santorum is hoping this tradition holds. Both candidates are trying to tap into their home base, Casey in Scranton and Santorum in Pittsburgh. Katya Schoenberg, Columbia Radio News.
For weeks now, pre-election polls have signaled danger for the Republicans. Tucker Bounds is the Republican National Committee press secretary for the Western states. I asked Bounds how he thinks Republicans will fare.
Well, Republicans, I think, are optimistic, but they have good reason to be somewhat hesitant to be overly optimistic. I mean, this is a challenging climate. I think that's well documented, and anyone that's been watching the news or reading the papers recognizes that there have been some setbacks for Republicans. I really feel good about where we are as Republicans because we have a record of being successful on those issues that speak specifically to safety and security here domestically, and about an aggressive fight on terrorism on foreign soil.
So what specifically are the volunteers and the party members doing these last weeks to get out the vote?
But what they're really focusing on is walking door-to-door and a very structured phone banking system that we put together. And they're able to get out there and talk really on a more personal level about the local candidate, which we think actually should do us some favors as far as battling a climate nationally at the 30,000-foot level in the debate that we've been seeing a lot of challenges and setbacks in. So, you know, if all this carries forth, and it certainly looks like it has, you know, again, it really is a reassuring thing, and Republicans should be optimistic.
So what is the most important issue for Republican voters this year? What's really getting people to the polls?
It's been proven time and time again that lots of voters will vote with their pocketbook. And if they've got a job, they've got low taxes, if they're able to make that extra vacation, or if they're able to put a little bit of extra money away for their kids' college accounts, you know, those actually do make a difference.
How much have the corruption scandals within the party hurt chances of a Republican majority in either house?
The corruption scandals, you know, they make good, you know, they make good news stories. And you know, myself, like everybody else, seems to enjoy following, you know, what's going on when these things, the more risque they get, it seems that the more electricity is behind the news. And I'll be the first person to admit that. These just aren't going to be the sorts of issues that voters, when they close the curtain behind them, are going to vote for.
All right, Tucker, I have one more question for you. What impact is the Saddam Hussein guilty verdict going to have on voter turnout?
I think that the Saddam Hussein guilty verdict really crosses partisan lines. I don't know if it's going to be a benefit for Republicans. I don't know if it's going to be a benefit for Democrats. I think that the incumbent in this situation would probably get maybe a little bit more credit because it was their policies that, you know, brought this brutal dictator to justice.
That was Tucker Bounds, press secretary for the Republican National Committee.
For the last 12 years, Democrats have been the minority party in Congress. This year, they hope to take back Capitol Hill. I spoke with Democratic Deputy Press Secretary Mark Postenbach, who called us from the party's national headquarters in Washington. I asked him what his party's been doing to turn things around.
The DNC has a 50-state strategy, which we started 2 years ago. The last election cycle, as you know, it was fought in maybe 17, 20 different states. And what Governor Dean's vision for the Democratic Party for the future was, so that we would fight in all 50 states, and not just those few 20. What that does is it makes us a national party again. And what it also does is makes us competitive in red states. And the difference here is that if you field good candidates in places where the Republican side didn't expect it, then you're able to force the Republicans to defend areas that they didn't have to defend before, and that ultimately will be more successful. It's a longer-term strategy, and I think it's something that you'll also pay dividends in this cycle.
How confident do you feel that your party can win a majority in this election?
And I think we'll make significant gains this election cycle. I think Americans are ready for a change from years of Republican Party leadership. And I just think that Americans who would normally not vote Democratic but normally vote Republican or would give our candidates a second look, and I think we'll be very successful.
If you are able to win a majority in both houses, what shifts in the Iraq war policy can we expect?
Well, I mean, ultimately, the president is the one that, you know, as commander-in-chief, directs and formulates our foreign policy and our military strategy. But I do think that if Democrats were to take back either the House and or the Senate, I think that you would see a much more robust oversight. I mean, frankly, for the past 6 years, the Republicans in Congress have not done their job in terms of holding the Bush White House accountable for its many missteps, including, you know, procurement, talking about all the graft that's happening in Iraq, the billions of dollars that have been wasted both through mismanagement and lack of oversight. I think that's something that you'll see a lot more of under a Democratic Congress, either both in the House or in the Senate.
What do you expect the deciding factors to be?
In the end, I think, you know, the American people's desire for change. You've seen Republican lobbyists go to jail. You've seen, in addition to Tom DeLay stepping down, Duke Cunningham, a congressman from the Southern California area. I mean, you've seen a lot of scandals, and I think the American people are pretty fed up with it. As I alluded to earlier, that Americans are ready for a new direction in Iraq. I think also the economy, too, is something that the American people are looking for a new direction on. President Bush talks almost every day about how great the economy is doing. Unfortunately, the polls don't bear that out. Democrats are looking to put into place economic policies that help America's working families and not just the few who will benefit from President Bush's tax cuts.
Any predictions for the House or Senate?
I think we're going to make some strong gains.
Thank you very much for speaking with us.
No problem. Take care.
Good night.
From the Democratic National Headquarters, Deputy Press Secretary Mark Postenbach. You're listening to Battleground 2006, live coverage of the midterm elections from the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. Our technical staff includes Mary Catherine Bruder, Warunkana Chumchun, Andrea Neem, and Agalos Petropoulos.
We had help from Craig Hedick, Lars Howell, and Rick Carr. Our technical director is Nick Medanis.
Polls in Virginia and New Jersey are about to close. We'll have live updates from our reporters there when we return at 8. I'm Brett Elliott.
And I'm Alexa Danner.